JBQ. You bring into the conversation a classic exception to what we all understand to be a dipole. A G5RB is not a dipole. It's modified, as Lewis Varney, whose call sign was G5, whose antenna was named after him and his call sign, G5RB. The transmission line is not coax all the way up to the antenna. The transmission line is kind of a hybrid. A G5RV, classically fed in the center, comes down about 27 feet from as high as you extend it, comes down about 27 feet, and all of that is 450 ohm ladder line. And ladder line is balanced. It's the same on both sides. So you must connect that to your coax run, ever how far it takes to go back to the shack. And that junction needs to be a transformer. The balanced to unbalanced transformer, the balance in that event, it's seen as much as the transmission line in coax, the transmission line in a ladder line is 450 ohms. You need a transformer. It transforms the impedance, the word that Chad doesn't like that much. It transforms the impedance from 50 ohms to 450 ohms, and the signal will work beautifully over that. There are different ways of modifying even the classic G5RV. You can put the feed point off center, and that changes things. It makes a G5RV more of a multiband antenna in that way. Anyway, does that clarify where the ballon is placed in a G5RV? And it is not the same place as you would with a standard dipole, coax all the way up to the antenna. KK4JBQ.
KI4DOS.
Go ahead, Gary.
You have to remember, there is no such thing, there's no such animal as a 50-ohm antenna. People say that, oh, it's 50 ohms. It's not. I have never seen a 50-ohm antenna. That's number one. Number two, the output of the transmitter is supposedly 50 ohms, and it probably is. I don't know. As far as that goes, you were talking about the G5RV. The ladder line Larry's talking about is part of the antenna. It's a vertical part that goes up to the dipole part, which helps to make it multi-band. But that part of the ladder line is part of the antenna. If you feed an antenna with ladder line from inside your house all the way out to the antenna, which is a good way to do it, that ladder line is still part of the antenna because it radiates. If it radiates, it's an antenna. If it doesn't, it's a bird perch.
Got it. Now, the ladder line is part of the antenna, but the coax cable is not, correct?
Can be, but it's like what Larry was talking about, balanced and unbalanced. The coax is not balanced, it's unbalanced. And if you noticed up at the beams, antennas on my tower, there's a big coil up there where the feed lines go up, and there's an RF choke up there, which helps prevent unwanted signals coming back down to the transmitter. That you could say is a ballon. It's an RF choke is what it is, but it's actually acts like a ballon in a lot of ways. But sometimes, you know, the coax can be part of the antenna. It will radiate. You can make an antenna out of coax. The double bazooka is actually made out of coax using the center shield. The center conductor and the shield. So you know, it's just all kinds of different animals. It's you know, you got to compare apples to apples instead of apples to oranges.
Well, this is probably the most interesting of all topics, and one that's special to me, because after I became a ham and after I became a member of the Blue Ridge Club, I was looking for a way to give back to the hobby that had given so much to me, including a relationship with all of you guys. And one thing I wanted to do was, for various reasons, I wanted to attend the testing sessions when I wasn't one of the people taking the test. I wanted to help out as I could, and I wanted to be there to represent the club, of course. But I found myself answering a lot of questions of people who had just gotten a new license, full of questions. And I would watch them leave, and there's a short distance between the exit of the room and the elevator. So I would intercept them, and I would say, well, now that you've got a license, do you have a question? What's top of your mind? And it was always the same thing. What radio should I buy? What, you know, how do I get started? Well, that taught me something, and it taught me that one of the misconceptions about this hobby is that the radio is the most important thing. I have learned that the antenna is the most important thing. You can have the best radio, spend all the money that, you know, just exhaust your bank account on equipment, but if you don't have a good antenna, it all that goes nowhere. The antenna is the transport device, which gets that signal out into the ether, as they call it. So, anyway, one thing that I learned about 10 years ago, surprised and shocked me, was that coax has three surfaces that it can radiate from, but that will transport the signal. And some of those, that signal transport can be detrimental. Well, at this break, number one, as you might guess, is the center conductor. And number two is the inside surface of the shield. And number three is the outside surface of the shield. Basic to this picture that I'm trying to draw in your mind is that signals go out to the antenna. They should not come back from the antenna. But a surface path for that does exist. And it's the outside surface of the shield. The shield has the side closest to the center conductor and the side closest to the sheath, or the, you know, the coating on the outside of the coax. So our signals are alternating current. They go up and they want to go out. If our antenna is the right design, they will go out, and all of that power is used, and we want all of that power to be utilized. We want an efficient antenna. If any of it comes back down comes back down the coax and gets back into the shack, we've got a problem. So thus we have choke, which is a one-to-one transformer. We have choke balance, you can call it that. And we have impedance transforming balance, which, for instance, with the G5RV, changes that impedance from 50 ohms, the design of the radio, through the coax, which should be kept 50 ohms all the way to the feed point. No, it's not a it's not a 50 ohm antenna, but that's the impedance that we offer to the antenna. If it can be something else, if we use 450 ohm or 650 ohm or, I'm sorry, 600 ohm, or even I've known people to use twin lead or 300 ohm transmission lines in amateur radio. But that additional path for the current to come back into your shack is carrying what's called common mode current. Current is the thing, if you remember Ohm's law, current is the thing that pushes the electromagnetic signal or our transmission out into the air. The current does that. And that current coming back into the shack can do mean things inside the shack. We want to keep it out. So, dismissing or eliminating that common mode current is one of the jobs of antenna design and something that you should be aware of. And if we have coax, we can lay it on the ground with no losses, really, because of the shielding, except when we have common mode current coming back, that is wasted. It'll actually go to the ground, that common mode current, and some of our energy is lost. The real trick here is to get all of the energy our radio creates out into the air. Not 10% of it, not 50% of it, but as much as possible. KK4JBQ.
And also one other interesting thing that I have heard a lot about, besides the interesting features of coax, is the interesting features of ladder line as well, such as you do not ever want your ladder line to touch the ground, or it will lose all the power that's going through it. I have heard that time and time and time and time again. And another thing interesting that I also heard is to always have a, usually you have your dipole antenna strung out across a field or wide open space or whatever. I've heard to always keep your grass cut underneath it, because the long, tall grass will absorb the signal, and the shorter grass and more open, empty ground will act as a ground plane and help bounce it up into the air away from everything.
Never heard that about the grass there, Daniel, but topography does have to do with that. Like I said, I never heard that about the grass, but who knows? It may affect it as well. If you've got a, depending on what type of soil you have, that does make a difference. And the lay of the land, of course, makes a difference. As you get into takeoff angles and all this other silly stuff. That's one of the things we don't know about, I guess, or at least I don't know about. I know if you have a relatively good grounding system and that sort of thing, it works real well. There's a lot of people, you've heard of a beverage antenna. That is not a transmitting antenna. That is a receive antenna. I've talked to hams that have just run out, 300, 400, 500 feet of wire across the yard, across their neighbor's yard, lay it on the ground, and use it as a receive antenna. You don't transmit off of it, but it works real well as a receive antenna. But Mr. Ray used to say a long time ago, if you had $100 to spend on your ham station, you spent $50 on the receiver, $10 on the transmitter, and the rest on your antenna. Just like Larry said, antennas is real important.
UE? 73, I'm going to secure my station. Y'all have a wonderful night. I'll be clear. KO4 NUE.
Oh, I am. I'm going to say 73's too. I done took my medicine and I've got to get up there and get in bed where I can get up and get my grandson to school in the morning. So, KI4 LZI, KI4 DOS, KK4 JBQ, and KK4 WCM. I think I've got all of you. I'm going to say 73's and head toward the bed. 73's, guys. Really enjoyed it.
They ain't never been clear. They just partly cloudy at best. 73's, Walt. 73 there, Chad. Just peeking at you a little bit. Y'all have a good evening. Get you some rest. Daniel, hope that helped you out some. Larry, thanks for the information. You're always a wealth of information. And Andy, appreciate you coming in there and, as well. I'm going to go ahead and make this my last transmission as well. I'm not going to bed just yet, but I've got some other things I need to get done before I go to bed. So y'all have a good evening, what's left of it. And before I go, Daniel, you've got a hum of some kind on your transmitter. I don't know if it's power supply or if something's not grounded real good or what. Just wanted to let you know about that. You're perfectly readable. It's just got a little tone. They got a little hum in the background. I just can't decide what it is yet.
I heard the hum myself and played around with it on Simplex and stuff with multiple radios so I can listen to it. It is the power supply that I'm talking off of. Definitely the power supply. I've tested that out. I can illustrate that at some other point in time by going over to a 12-volt battery, but it's not this radio and it's not the other one. Both of them do it. And it's just the power supply that I'm using. It's that great big 35-amp one, and I don't know how to get rid of the hum.
A bad filter cap in it there somewhere, and that's what's causing it. Probably just have to change out the filter caps on it. That's no big deal. If you need a different power supply, let me know. I got a couple here that will probably do what you need to do. That being said, 73, everyone, KJ4WZM, KK4JBQ, KI4LZI, and if you're back in there yet, and Chad and Walt's already left, so I think that's everybody. If I miss somebody, I apologize. Y'all have a good evening. 73, KI4DOS.
The thing about electricity is it's just magic.
JBQ, go ahead, Daniel.
Got it cleared off. Hope y'all have a great night, and thanks for the power cord, Gary. I really appreciate it. I really needed it. And thank you for all the helpful tips there, Larry. I really needed all that, and I'm going to keep doing me a little bit more research here before I get up and running on HF. But I did want to tell Andy KI4LZI, if you're still in here, Andy, I did want to tell you that I did get that radio up and running. In fact, this is its first test here. I just wanted to make sure that it was running good, and it actually works. I heard a rumor that there was something wrong with this radio, but it has just been the power supply that it was hooked up to. So that's good.
Andy excused himself. He takes his insulin about now, and he'll be back with us. Well, I'll say goodnight to everyone who has jumped out. It's fine to meet with all of you here on Tuesday nights. I'm feeling a little exhausted myself, so as Chad sometimes does, I'll give everybody a fair warning that I'm about to run down. KK4JBQ.
Larry, well, I guess I'm probably about to be the only one in here now, but I'm really excited about finally about to be back on HF again. I'm really happy about that. I haven't been on HF in years.
Well, is that because you lost the radios somehow that you were using?
Radios are at my parents' house, and they don't use them anymore, but they're not up for grabs either. They're just kind of sitting on them, and I think the antenna eventually came down out of the trees, too. My family, pretty much none of them do ham radio now at all anymore. I'm the only one. And it's kind of an odd feeling, kind of sad in a way, all lonely. 7 of us got our licenses. 5 of us are still licensed, and only one stays on the radio.
It's unfortunate. I had met maybe all members of your family, and I had a lot of respect for your folks who raised a good bunch of kids, and including yourself. And I think at one time, your youngest brother was the youngest extra class ham that I was aware of. So he really excelled. He would probably excel at anything he tries. But anyway, that is what it is. I'm thrilled that you stayed in the hobby and that you still struggle to understand the complexity of it. It is complex. How everything affects everything. That is very true. And if you've taken, certainly the general test and absolutely the extra exam, you know that there's a lot of math involved, and there's a reason for that. designing the equipment that we use day in and day out, the little handheld that I'm using right now, it's a massive thing, an undertaking. And we're, as human beings, all of us, at least in this day, we're accustomed to using things like appliances, you know, the appliances we use. We don't understand how they work. We could not fix them. There was a day when members of this hobby and service made their own radios. And when they broke, they repaired their own radios. That day is gone. I've heard many people say that they can't even see the minute circuit components that our radios are made of today. But still, we're challenged to understand how they work. And that will serve us no matter what equipment we use. Our own radios of our own design and construction, or somebody else's radio. It always scared me. I know if Gary's still listening. It always scared me on a field day to walk up to a radio that I'd never seen before. Didn't know the layout of the buttons, if it were a front panel full of buttons, or certainly the menus that are on modern radios. But just a little bit of time spent, if you understand what all the controls will eventually do, you can get there. You won't be an expert, but you can operate the radio. And that's kind of important to understand what is actually happening. Because you won't have a day when there won't be a challenge of some sort. A challenge to what you know about what is happening when you push the button. KK4 JBQ.
True, and I like that too. Good explanation there of what it's like encountering new radios. I can't agree more. My handheld radio that I have come to love, it's made by Anytone. Model is ATD878UV. That is the neatest little handheld radio I've ever encountered, and I couldn't recommend the radio more. But when I got the radio, I was so intimidated by it. I didn't even know where to begin. I was completely lost in it. And I spent weeks pouring through the instructions and pouring through the menu and figuring everything out. Now, most of the stuff, I can fly through the menu real quick and tweak a little thing here and there, and boom, the radio comes to life in my hands. It's great. The Kenwood TS-2000 is one of the radios that you're mentioning at Field Day, with a whole array of buttons across the front of it. And at first I found that radio intimidating too, until I learned what all those buttons did. And I learned that radio pretty decently. I didn't know everything about it, but I knew enough about it to be able to work on it pretty much any band in several different modes and know exactly what was going on and how to use it. And I wanted one. I still want one. The HF radio that I have now is designed to be used as a mobile rig, and everything on here, it does a lot of the same stuff as that one with all the buttons on the face of it, but it has all these menus on it now with letter abbreviations for stuff, and you press the menu button, you scroll through four different menus, and everything's abbreviated in initials for everything. There's very little space on the screen, so it's very difficult to tell what's going on with it. But I was able to, when I turned the radio on, it was set to 3.915, which is South Carolina single sideband net on 80 meters. And I managed to turn it over to 6.1 and make sure that it had the negative offset and all that to be able to operate it just now and plug in my antenna into the right slot and all that stuff. So I figured my way out on this radio, but it's definitely very different, and I know probably 5% of the functionality that this radio is capable of.
Remind me again the model of your radio.
Radio or the one that I'm talking on?
The one you're talking on.
706. Mark 2G, I think it is.
Radio. Actually, it's it's a very desirable radio, a classic. Hang on just a second. I'm back. When you connect that radio to the power supply, that's, we understand, it's faulty now. It does have, and it's just in the background, but it's a consistent tone, and it kind of messes with your transmission, garbles your speech from time to time. Gary was very likely right on the nose when he said it was a filter capacitor. Those things have quite a lot of voltage, somewhere 450 to 600 volts. And anyway, when you open it up to change the capacitors, the common thing people do is to change them all at one time because they all have age on them, and that's what makes a capacitor die is advanced age. And get somebody to help you with that. It's just the wise thing to do. Someone who has changed capacitors before. I know there's a lot of people that you talked with tonight who can help you with that. KK4JBQ.
And something interesting about this power supply, the hum outside of the power supply is audible as well. You can hear it hum. When I key the radio up, I can hear it hum even louder. Any little change in what is being drawn out of this power supply makes it hum. And it's sitting probably 5 or 6 feet away from me right now, and I can hear it humming. And if you hold the power supply in your hands, it's warm, and you can feel the 60-cycle vibration in it, too. It sits there and hums in your hands. It vibrates from the hum. It's definitely on borrowed time, and it needs some help. It's 35 amps. It's not a wimpy power supply, but it's audible both over the radio wave and actually
audible. He can hear it humming in the room and feel it humming if you touch it.
Interesting. KK4JBQ. Interesting that you can hear it in the room with you. I guess it would have to be said that that is an oscillation at a particular frequency, and it doesn't seem, as I said, it doesn't warble, it doesn't change. It may change when you key up, but we don't hear it before you key up, so it is an oscillation, so there's something in there, and it could actually be the effects that the bad filter capacitor is having on the transformer. As I understand it, this is not a switching mode power supply. It's actually a linear power supply with an actual transformer inside. One clue would be that it's quite heavy. Those transformers are quite heavy and making the switching power supply and how light they are. They don't have a transformer in them. How light they are, they're desirable, and when they are designed and built well, they truly are a good piece of gear to have. I have a linear power supply here that I don't use with my radio because it's kind of running away with the voltage. It's near 15 volts output instead of 13.8. And I've just not gotten around to fix that. And my other radio is the Yaesu 857 Delta. That one I put away to keep it from being damaged by the flooding that we would have in this room from time to time. And it's still in the box. It's one thing that I need to address. Because that's a nice radio, and like yours, it's a small mobile unit. All bands, all modes. And the 891, I believe, replaces that radio. I believe that is it, the Yaesu 891. KK4JBQ.
KI4LCI, I believe you're right about that.
Jim, yep. This power supply does not weigh a gram under 30 pounds. It's immensely heavy. It is almost half the size of a small microwave oven. And the hum doesn't vary in frequency, but it gets louder when I key the radio up. Just a little bit louder. I can tell when I hit the key. It just gets slightly louder than it was. And yes, it's definitely a linear power supply. Very, very, very heavy. It gets warm. And that's what it is. I'll have to look up switching power supplies and see about getting one of those instead. And another thing is, this power supply, at one point, I moved it around and the radio cut off. I put a voltmeter to it and it was producing 1.5 volts. And I turned it off, turned it back on, and tapped on the top of it, and it jumped from 1.5 volts to 13.8. It's dead on the money at 13.8, but something goes wrong with it where if you bump it in any kind of way, the voltage drops through the floor, and I'm not sure why, so I was real careful with it, didn't move it around, just set it down very, very gently, and that's where I have the radios, what I have the radios running off of right now. But when KF4MLN was around, his equipment got bumped around from time to time. It would get pulled because he'd stretch the cords or whatever, trying to reach things from different parts of his house in an effort not to move more than he had to. And he would think that the finals would go out in a radio or something because that power supply that he had stuff hooked up into, the voltage would drop to like a volt and cut the radio off. So he thought that the finals were blew up in just about every radio that he had. But it's actually the power supply that's the issue. Something's wrong on the inside of it. And I'm kind of scared to open it up because I know this is a big power supply with a lot of capacitors and stuff in it. and I don't know much about the inside or how to fix it or how to see what's wrong with it. But I heard, one more thing before I get off and hand it back to Andy. That 857D is, like you mentioned, like this radio, is highly sought after. That 857D was like the backpacking radio to go with people that wanted to do QRP out in the woods on all bands on one single radio. That's the one they use because it's very, very small. It's the size of a small mobile rig, actually, and very lightweight, very portable, very versatile. And that was used a lot with QRP backpacking on batteries. Seen a lot of stuff about it. The radio's weakest link is the front display occasionally goes out on some of the radios. I'll go ahead and hand it to Andy real quick. KJ4WZM. Andy, pick it up.
KI4LCI. The true backpacking radio is the 818, which replaced 817. Those about 5 to 6 watt transceivers. That's 100 watt Larry's got. Now the 891, I haven't read deep enough about it or to find out exactly everything about it, but the true backpacker was the 5-6 watt kind. 817, which was replaced by the 818. But the 857D is quite small. But I believe, Larry can verify it for me, but I believe that was a 100 watt radio, if I'm not mistaken. KI4LCI.
JPQ, you're right, Andy. The 857 is 100 watts on HF, and VHF, I believe, is 75 and UHF 50. When they designed these radios, the shorter wavelengths are more dangerous to nearby humans, let's say. And if you have a mobile radio, it's sitting in the antennas just, you know, within several feet of you. So those high frequency waves, they don't build them with the same amount of power output that you would have available to you on the HF lower frequency bands. At least the way that I understand the limitations. And you know, think about it. If you're holding a handheld with an antenna attached, it's within inches of your head. KK4JBQ.
Pretty true about that. That radio, it can produce up to 100 watts on HF, but it can also be turned down a lot. I think mine also produces about 100 watts on HF, but it steps down to, I think, 50 watts for 6 meters, 20 watts for VHF, and then it drops down even more. I think it's like 5 or 10 watts for VHF. This radio steps down a lot in power from what I was reading as you change the frequencies.
Why? Daniel, back to your power supply. Do you know whether that power supply has tubes?
It does. It looks way too new for tubes.
It's possible still. If it's solid state, the device that has replaced tubes in newer models are called MOSFETs. And they're not susceptible to the oscillations that tubes are capable of. What we're hearing might be the result of a capacitor going bad and affecting a tube and making it oscillate. The thing that really makes me curious about what's really the problem is the fact that you can hear it. You're not hearing it over the air. You're hearing it in the room from the power supply. It's oscillating.
Capacitors don't normally have any ability to oscillate themselves, but they can affect a tube to do that. Does this power supply, I'm sure it has a fan. They all get warm. If it has venting, and I'm sure it does, peek in there and see if you see any tube filaments. KK4JBQ.
The heat sink, and it doesn't have a fan. The radio I'm talking on actually has a fan that kicks on the moment I transmit, and the longer I key up, the faster the fan speeds up on it. But the power supply itself does not have a fan, just a big heavy heat sink. And when you touch the power supply, you can feel the 60 cycle hum in it too.
Just out of curiosity, you got any idea how old this power supply is that Al had? Because he's, as we all know, he dealt with some very, very ancient gear at a lot of times here. KI4LCI. Any idea of his age?
In just a minute, see what I can try to figure out. If I had a guess, I'd say it was produced towards the end of the 90s. I don't think it's older than me at all.
Perhaps it could be then, but it's definitely, as you say, got some issue. Go ahead, Larry, KI4LCI.
The fact that it has what appears to be heat sinks, you still have to verify this by opening it up. And if you do that, if you open it up, be careful to keep your hands out of it. There are some high voltages inside. But if it has large heat sinks, it probably has MOSFETs that's creating the power transformation, the rectifiers that is rectifying the voltage. They will get warm. I'm surprised it doesn't have a fan. The one that I have sitting here is, oh goodness, I think it's about the same wattage output. And I can hear the fan. It's quite, it's not silent. I can hear it when it switches on, but I really have to listen for it. Well, the final thing I'd want to say about that power supply is that it's absolutely worth fixing. When it is, when you go through it and correct all the things that might be wrong with it, and it's working solid, it'll work the rest of your natural life. They are very reliable, and they don't introduce the switching noise, the RF switching noise that modern power supplies will often do. They have a switching transistor in there that that changes the sine wave of the output and thus transforms the voltages. And it does that at tens of thousands of cycles per second. And depending on how well it's made, how well it's filtered, and filter capacitors introduce cost. And so let me tell you something funny. I once learned that this was in the age of televisions with CRTs, or cathode ray tubes, and RCA. They were the first manufacturers to make television popular, in the U.S. anyway. And so they'd make a set. It would come off the electrical engineer's design draft board, and they make a prototype, and they got that prototype to work. And then, because they wanted to cut costs as much as they could, they started removing parts. And if it quit working, they put that part back in. But if it still worked, as far as they could tell, if it still worked okay without that part, well, they saved that, the cost of that part, times 40 million, you know. They saved a lot of money by taking parts out. And this has become a practice even unto today. You'll see some circuit boards with holes in there and even patterns in the etched board to indicate that there should be a part there, and they've left it out for reasons of cost. And the quality goes down, the life expectancy probably goes down. But that linear power supply is very likely worth keeping. KK4JBQ.
KJ4WZM.
That's a guy for ID here. Let's see, who you take it, think?
John, RS35A. I just looked this power supply up. It is indeed a linear power supply. It actually weighs less than what I said it did. It weighs 27 pounds, not 30. It sells for $200. And it is not fan cooled. And after looking this thing up, this is a very common, very high quality amp. Well, not amp, very high quality power supply. It has outstanding ratings, so I bet that there is a lot of rebuild stuff available for it. I'm not sure how old this thing is, what the production date is on it, but there's a lot of these for sale in the $200 to $250 range. This is a good power supply, it looks like.
Well, they're still making the Astron power supply steel, so you could probably still find some part somewhere still for it. Go ahead, Larry, KI4LCI.
I agree. They're probably still making replacement parts. Whether they're in great supply, that's something I worry about every day. Whether if something happens to my automobile, it can even be fixed today because of these supply chain problems with electronics. So, what can we do? We're all crossing our fingers that what we enjoy using, which might have been repairable at some point, if it should fail, will it continue to be repairable? The world is changing right around us. But anyway, when you do get in there, the prudent thing to do would be to replace all of the capacitors, whatever their function is, because the capacitors become leaky, and not so much that they ooze their contents out into the into the case. They become electrical leaky. If they can become a dead short, and you know, then you get a puff of smoke. You let all of the RF smoke out of it, as some say. But when they become electrically leaky, they're becoming more and more like a resistor. A capacitor becoming and acting like a resistor, this is not a good thing. So they fail over a period of time, and they present different characteristics that we don't want, like this hum or a failing. If it is a tube, this one not maybe, but if it is a tube device with capacitors, they can damage the rectifier tubes. They can damage oscillator tubes within vintage equipment, boat anchors, that kind of thing. So you may have heard Walt talk about a capacitor kit. Knowing that this is a common thing to do, replace all the capacitors at one time, this is how you can get them one at a time, but it's more economical to get them as a kit and replace them all at one time. Walt has done that. It's just a very good thing to do if you want it to live, and if you want your work to count for something, because you could replace one thing that's obviously bad and other things that are going bad, will make that bad. The new part, it'll make that bad. So capacitors are suspect. KK4JBQ.
There was a time, I don't know when, or even if I have, I guess on 1946, Silvertone I got sitting over here. We're talking about 80 years ago, 80, 81 years ago. The capacitors were notoriously bad about being paper capacitors. Like with this old radio here, I didn't get it. Last time it was played, my great aunt played, it was probably 56, 57, somewhere in that range. And I got it back working, I guess, what was it, 10, 11 years ago. I told them to replace all those paper capacitors in it. And it's just, as he said, a good idea. I don't know if they're still using a lot of them or if they're no more using them, but there was a time with really, sure enough, prehistoric electronics that they were paper. And over a period of time of non-use, they'll go, sure enough, go bad. KI4LZI.
Folks, I'm in the process of looking into that. They do make a capacitor kit for a number of these power supplies made by this manufacturer, and I'm in the process right now of looking through them to figure out what I would get. And this particular power supply, that looks like it's a pretty common issue for the power, the capacitors to fail. And some people are reporting when their capacitors go out that it limps along okay with a 5 to 7 amp load, but when you step it up, it goes crazy. Different things like that. So I'm going to keep reading about this stuff and see what I can do about it. It likely is a capacitor issue.
4JBQ. Well, Daniel, even if it's not a capacitor issue now, it will become a capacitor issue at some point in the future. And you have a nice piece of equipment there, and you want to maintain it in such a way that it won't catastrophically fail at some point and damage other equipment connected to it. After all, every piece of equipment is going to need a power supply. And with 35 amps, you can get one of those, well, I don't know, it probably, being the vintage that it is, it probably doesn't have Anderson power pole connectors as an output from the power supply. But this is one thing that you could do with that amp is to feed its power into a distribution box, which in itself can be individually fused and maybe have, oh, let's just say six outputs, and one of them can go to, I mean, a lot of things in the shack run on 12 volts or 13.8. They run on the power that this can output. But you need to have some way of distributing that power and limiting the drain on that individual circuit, and those devices are fuses. So you can have, for your radio, you can have a 25 amp fuse or 20 amps or whatever, you know, is prudent to have for your radio. But another device running on 12 volts, it may only have a light bulb in it, an SWR meter, if you have one of those in line. It doesn't need a 25 amp fuse, it needs a 5 amp fuse. So anyway, there's something to think about up the road. Get this repaired, and then you can build, there is an outfit, you can type in amateur radio workbench into a search engine. And these people have a podcast weekly, I believe it is, where they discuss the building of accessories. And one of the things that they offer is a kit that you can build yourself. I think all you need is
you know, screwdrivers and that kind of thing. Comes with a case and everything. All the skill you really need is the skill to solder. And if you have that, you can build yourself a little distribution box for 12 volts for your shack. Amateur radio workbench. Anyway, I'm about to, it's midnight, and I'm going to let this drop for a second.